Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Did you vote by mail in the last election? Vote early. Well, that could change after tomorrow. During the pandemic, the legislature authorized no-excuse mail-in voting, expanded early voting hours, and expanded early voting locations. Those changes expire tomorrow, and it appears that the legislature will not extend or preserve them. With the pandemic still upon us and a half a dozen communities with local elections in the next few months, the state's top election official not happy about it. Joining us on the line now, Massachusetts Secretary of State Bill Galvin. Secretary Galvin, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be with you.
So no excuse mail-in goes away. Expanded early voting goes away. You are frustrated about it. Why?
Well, because everyone says they're for it. And we've had a tremendous success with this in Massachusetts, not just at the three elections we held in 2020, the presidential election, the presidential primary, and our regular state primary. We had record turnouts in all three of them, helped by that. But we've also seen it used very effectively at local municipal elections in 2020 and throughout this year in 2021, including today, where we have a special election for the state Senate going on in a number of communities of Boston and north of Boston, which all have used it effectively. It's been used by Democrats and Republicans. So if everyone's for it and it's worked very well, why is it ending? That's my problem.
So a couple of follow-up questions. You just mentioned the special election, the primary, what's going on today, some of the communities affected there, Winthrop, Revere, parts of Boston and Cambridge. Then there are upcoming elections, Norwood, Concord, Wellesley, Duxbury in January. The primary today, does that mean people may have voted in some way for the primary election today for the 1st Suffolk and Middlesex districts, and they couldn't vote that same way for the general election?
Absolutely
in January?
Correct. Thousands, in fact,
and how
in all those communities.
How confusing will that be? Well, I mean, who's most likely to be disenfranchised?
The issue will there be a contested election? There is no, at the current time, there is no Republican candidate scheduled to appear on the final ballot. And that's been used by those who are trying to suggest, well, this isn't a big deal. But it could well be by the end of today, there will be a Republican candidate. There was an effort by a Republican to get enough signatures. He failed, but he didn't fail by that much. He may choose to try to get Republican write-ins today. There could be other possibilities on that front. That illustrates the problem, but the problem is bigger than that. For instance, on January 4th, Norwood has three candidates running to fill a select person position on the board of the select board. Other communities, I think the one that struck me the most, in the town of Belchertown, there's a recall of two school committee members over the issue of potential vaccine mandates. Now, Belchertown is not a very large town. It is a significantly sized town. But the point is many people who may be concerned about going out to vote in person, legitimately or not, maybe they have issues that they're personally concerned about, they will not have the opportunity to vote by mail. They can try to construct an argument that they are an absentee voter. But this is, as I said, this is ridiculous. Everyone says they're for it. It's worked well. And I think what's particularly galling to me is, you know, we see what's going on nationally and around the country, the obvious and relentless effort to restrict the rights of voters for partisan reasons. We should be leading in the opposite direction, not quibbling over, well, I sent it here and they sent it over to us and we sent it back to them. And I want to say the state Senate has tried several times. I want to be very clear about that. Senator Cindy Cream in particular has been very aggressive on this, extending it. But the fact of the matter is we sit here today and the Senate bill, which was passed with a number of provisions beyond simply the ones we've been speaking about, is not being considered, but was not considered by the House.
So, Secretary, I'm sorry, I need to have you take a break so I can catch listeners up on a few things as we go through. So first, to backtrack, Concord, Wellesley, Duxbury, their elections are February, March. The Norwood election, January 3rd. And we'll see if we can get the date on the Belchertown election that you're telling us.
I believe it's the
24th. Yep, January 24th. And now what you've moved into is the conversation about what's happening in the legislature, where the House in June, in a essentially a budget bill, had taken some of this up. Then the Senate Senate passed its own legislation in October. The two chambers have not been able to put that together and put something together and pass it going forward after tomorrow. And I do want to play you a little bit of sound from the Speaker, Ron Mariano, who was asked about why the legislature appears to be letting these things expire on WCVB's On the Record Sunday. Here he is. That'd be ELX1. Okay, we don't have that sound. I'll just go on. He said we haven't debated those other things in the Senate bill. To your point, this is a back and forth. Everybody wants it. Why not the legislature do something to just project to extend the measures 2 or 3 months in order to cover these short-term elections?
Well, I proposed it. That's exactly what I proposed. In fact, I proposed to extend to June 30th. The legislature's deadline for action in an election year by their own rules is July. So they would end their session in July of 2022. So I said, well, let's go to June 30th, which also tends to be the end of the municipal election cycle that begins in March. These are mostly town elections. And nothing's happened. I mean, it has happened a couple of times before that. Is to say they've extended it previously, but they have not done it.
All right. So
the reality is it expires. We've got to do something about it. And the simplest action is the one you just proposed and what I propose, which is to extend the existing situation as we have it, nothing more, but nothing less. And that hasn't happened.
So I do want to ask you one other thing before we let you go. You made reference to a pattern that we are seeing around the country of state legislatures taking over elections processes, shifting oversight, more control to legislatures, which are more partisan bodies. An ABC News analysis over the summer found at least 8 states have done so recently, including Arizona and Georgia. I want to ask you, from where you sit, would such moves be possible in Massachusetts?
Well, when you say changes, I don't think we're going to see the type of the dramatic changes. I think that would be honest to say that we would. We have seen on a very small level some degree of change, though, like that. We had the legislature changing the process by which local communities drew their boards and precincts. The reason being they wanted to have an influence on it in terms of the drawing of legislative districts. So you can see that occur. I oppose that, and we're still working through the mess that was made by it. But the fact of the matter is what's going on in other parts of the country is far more sinister. I think here we just have an inability to have an adult conversation about something that's very important. And I think it's the issue of priority. I think voters need to tell their legislators straight up, this is a priority. This is about the right to vote. And we shouldn't be making it, even if it's legitimate, well-intentioned disagreement between people, which will give them the benefit of the doubt, it's no excuse for not having an option to voters for these important offices and significant offices at the local level.
And Secretary, we are talking elections in 2022. Have you made your decision? Do you plan to run for re-election?
Well, I'm going to answer you the same way I've answered everybody else. First of all, I'm kind of busy. I'm running an election today. Secondly, I enjoy what I do, and I think I do it as well as I can. And I'm pleased with the results we saw in 2022. So, but I want to get these reforms passed, and I don't want it to be perceived as, well, he's simply doing that for this. I'm obviously very interested in making sure the elections in Massachusetts continue to run well in 2022 and beyond.
Massachusetts Secretary of State Bill Galvin, always good to have you. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Lisa Kaczynski is author of Politico's Massachusetts Playbook. She was listening to that conversation, joins us now. Lisa, welcome back to you.
Thanks so much for having me.
So first, just quick reactions to what you heard from the secretary.
This is what we've been hearing for a while. The secretary is frustrated. Voting rights groups are frustrated that the legislature isn't even doing this temporary extension that he said, and is just, they're poised to let this expire tomorrow. And the secretary has been saying repeatedly and warning repeatedly about these municipal elections that are coming up. And, if there is a Republican that emerges in that special state Senate election, that this could make a difference and be very confusing for voters.
So I want to be clear that we have reached out to the chairs of the legislature's Joint Committee on Election Laws for comment. Neither responded. Secretary Galvin obviously has his opinions on why the legislature hasn't acted. What have you heard? Why are we going to see this stuff expire tomorrow?
There hasn't been a lot of push this fall, especially in the run-up to the end of formal session right before Thanksgiving. This isn't an issue that's been at the forefront, which is interesting because House and Senate leadership, particularly House Speaker Ron Mariano and Senate President Karen Spilka, they've both expressed support for this quite publicly. The House Speaker had said that again just on WCVB's On the Record this past weekend. But they are trying to accomplish this in two different ways. You know, as you had mentioned earlier, the House passed a provision in a supplemental budget bill, the Senate passed the Votes Act, and there just hasn't seemed to be a lot of urgency in trying to, get to a compromise, between these two chambers. And something to remember, too, is that both of the bills that they're proposing don't cover a lot of municipal elections, particularly the off-year ones. So maybe that's something that has to do with, the urgency of some of the elections that the Secretary of State talked about maybe aren't in the purview of the bills that are currently sitting on Beacon Hill.
So given that we know what's likely to happen tomorrow, sometime in the future, next year, do you see the legislature bringing, no excuse vote by mail and extended early voting back in some form?
I do. The Votes Act had passed through the Senate, which is the bill that would, move this forward. That passed the Senate, 36-3, with the Republicans voting against it. And there are a lot of people who have signed on to that in the House as well, at least the initial bill. And there is a lot of appetite on Beacon Hill to do something about this, to keep this. Lawmakers, particularly Democratic lawmakers, Republicans have, voiced opposition to this for myriad reasons. But there is a lot of support among Democratic lawmakers who saw this as successful and saw this as a way to maybe encourage some voter participation. It's just a matter of time until they, really get to work hashing out the details and the differences between their proposals.
All right. That is Lisa Kaczynski, political reporter and author of the Massachusetts Playbook. Thanks for the time today. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
So in just a little bit, we will take your calls for Ask the Doctors. The number for that, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Before we turn to those doctors and your calls, we have some other questions. We are all on Omicron watch, and we had a chance to ask Dr. Dan Baruch one of our burning questions. How well do our current vaccines and boosters protect against Omicron? Dr. Baruch is the director of the Center for Virology and Vaccine Research at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. And perhaps most importantly, it is the lab that helped design one of the three approved vaccines, Johnson & Johnson. We caught up with Dr. Baruch a little earlier today and started with what his lab is seeing in terms of variants.
What we're seeing is the emergence of a new SARS-CoV-2 variant called Omicron. We've seen new variants emerge several times during the pandemic, and Omicron is different than some of the others. First, it has many more mutations throughout the virus, but particularly in the spike protein, than any other variants we've seen. So it raises the concern that it may partially evade antibodies, both from natural infection and vaccines. It also appears to be spreading very rapidly. It has already become the dominant virus in South Africa, and it's rapidly making inroads in the UK, as well as been detected in many states in the United States.
Remind us, please, what a spike protein is and why the variants on the spike protein could be so troubling.
So the spike protein is the outer protein of the virus. If you think of a cartoon of the virus, it's the thing that sort of sticks up from the ball. And the reason why the spike protein is important is it's the target of antibodies. It's what your body makes antibodies against to try to eliminate the virus. It also is used to infect cells. Basically, if the spike protein has a lot of mutations, then it could infect people a lot more easily, and it also could evade antibodies. And those are the things that we worry about.
You have a view in that very few people ever will, and the history books will later tell us, right? But we get a chance to talk to you now on Omicron. On a scale from 1 to 5 of worry, 1 being the lowest, where are you now and where were you when you first heard about it?
Well, I actually first heard about Omicron on Thanksgiving Day. I received some email communications from some colleagues who track variants, and there was a lot of alarm that was being sounded on Thanksgiving Day and the day prior that a highly mutated variant was emerging in South Africa. And then the South African researchers presented their results on the day after Thanksgiving. And that led to a lot of global concern.
What are you most tracking now about Omicron? Is it transmissibility, level of severity? Is it its resistance to the current vaccines? What are you paying most close attention to?
We're very interested in all of those questions. In our own lab, we're looking at the ability of the Omicron variant to resist vaccines and whether that will necessitate booster shots, whether that will necessitate revision of the vaccines to make Omicron-specific vaccines moving forward. But we're also following very closely the news reports of how it's spreading in South Africa, in the UK, in Europe, in the United States, and other places.
So several questions coming out of that. You talked about the possibility of having to develop a variant-specific booster. Is it just a matter of time before that's going to be necessary, or is it possible that the vaccines that we're using already can be boosted in their current form and we might only ever need that? We might not ever need to develop a variant-specific booster. Just trying to understand if that's just a matter of time or not.
Well, that's a major question that many groups are trying to answer. It's clear that the original vaccine series have far reduced ability to neutralize Omicron compared with previous variants. There's also emerging data from multiple groups that a booster dose does increase the ability of the antibodies to recognize Omicron, but it's still lower. And how much lower and whether that's transient or whether that's durable remains to be determined.
So I would like to talk about the J&J vaccine for a few minutes now. Your lab helped design that vaccine. Initially offered really tremendous promise, especially as a single-dose vaccination that was easier to store and transport, similar efficacy to the mRNA vaccines. Then, of course, came news about the potential for blood clots, and then with Delta and now Omicron, decreased efficacy, also noting the mRNAs have decreased efficacy with Omicron. Has the trajectory of the J&J vaccine hit bumps that you anticipated, or has the trajectory and the bumps and the slow roll of the vaccine been different than what you thought when it first came out?
Well, I think there have been some bumps in the road. I think the manufacturing slowdown was one of the most important reasons why it rolled out more slowly than we had anticipated. It is on a trajectory to have at least 1 billion doses, if not 2 billion doses, by the end of next year.
And are you feeling good about its long-term efficacy? And how are you feeling now about warnings about blood clots and other concerns?
I think whenever you roll out a vaccine into tens or hundreds of millions of people, then there will be the emergence of rare side effects. And I think we've seen that with pretty much all the vaccines throughout the world. So I think it's important to keep the very rare risks in perspective. And for, I think, all the vaccines, the benefits substantially outweigh the risks.
And to be clear, the risk of blood clotting was quite rare with the Johnson & Johnson vaccine and primarily affected women ages 30 to 39. Have we reached a stage, and this conversation came up as the FDA and CDC were doing their work in the late summer, early fall, have we reached a point where it's likely that at some point the J&J vaccine will be considered a two-dose vaccine in order for somebody to be fully vaccinated? So not including boosters, just basic vaccination.
It depends on how you define fully vaccinated. There may come a time where fully vaccinated will be defined as three doses of the mRNA vaccines or two doses of the J&J vaccine, but we're not quite there yet. But all the vaccines benefit from a booster dose.
And on that booster, I know you know J&J vaccinated folks have the option to choose their booster. At this point, basically, one is allowed to mix and match. J&J is the only vaccine developed using a different method than the mRNA. So Pfizer and Moderna were a different method. Do you have a strong feeling about whether people who are eligible for a booster, who originally had J&J, should get J&J as their booster or should mix with Pfizer and Moderna?
The data on a second dose of the J&J vaccine has very strong efficacy, showing increase in protection compared with a single dose of the J&J vaccine. So a two-dose version of the J&J vaccine gives efficacy in the United States in the 94% range. We don't really have efficacy data with the mix and match approach, but there are theoretical benefits. There are interesting immune data in terms of antibody and T-cell responses that might suggest that if you mix and match vaccines, then there could be some benefits. But there isn't a lot of human clinical efficacy data yet.
So again, you have eyes in on this pandemic in a way that very few people do. We are in this moment, Delta still surging, Omicron increasingly present, not sure whether Omicron will overtake Delta or not. But also, we know people are tired. We're seeing pandemic fatigue. We're seeing worry and exhaustion. What do you think is the most important thing we need to do as a nation right now to get over the next hurdle in this pandemic?
Well, we're about 2 years into the pandemic, about a year after highly effective vaccines have become available, and yet we're still seeing surging cases, new variants, increasing hospitalizations, and increasing pandemic restrictions. So I fully understand how people are tired and really want the pandemic to be over and be done with. But we're not there yet. And I think that we do need to maintain a substantial amount of attention to the pandemic. Otherwise, it could get worse. So I think the most important thing now is for people to get vaccinated, and if they're eligible, then to get a booster. In addition, I think it's important for people to follow their public health guidance about indoor masking and other methods of keeping everybody safe. As much as we would like to be done with the pandemic, it's not done with us yet.
All right, that is Dr. Dan Baruch, Director of the Center for Virology and Vaccine Research at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. His lab helped design the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. Thanks for joining us, Dr. Baruch.
Thank you very much.
It is time to ask the doctors. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK for your coronavirus questions. What do you need to know about rapid at-home testing? Should you be masking? When and where should you be masking? Which booster is right for you? Is it just a matter of getting one as soon as you can? Here to help answer your calls, Dr. Cassandra Pierre, an infectious disease physician and assistant professor of medicine at the Boston University School of Medicine. She is also the medical director of public health programs and the associate hospital epidemiologist at Boston Medical Center. Also with us, Dr. Philip Landrigan, a pediatrician, public health physician, epidemiologist, and director of the Program for Global Public Health at Boston College. Dr. Pierre, welcome back.
Thanks. Great to be here.
And Dr. Landrigan, welcome back to you as well.
Thank you, Tiziana. Lovely to be here.
Great to have you both. And the lines are full already, so I'm going to actually start right away with a call. 1-800-423-8255. We're going to pick up Masha in Dorchester. Masha, you are on. What is your question for Drs. Pierre and Landrigan?
Oh, yes. Hi. Thank you. My 94-year-old mom is not vaccinated, and she has been diagnosed with congestive heart failure and somehow has become worried that the vaccines could aggravate her heart condition. I'd just like to know whether or not there is any merit in her fear.
Thanks for the question, Masha. Dr. Pierre, are you able to answer that question for Masha?
Yes, Masha, thank you for calling. That definitely sounds concerning. I will say that, you know, we've understood from some time that people like your mom who are older and have underlying health conditions are better served by getting vaccinated. We know that the risks of the vaccines are very low, and the benefits outweigh those risks, especially because we know COVID itself can aggravate and worsen her underlying heart condition and also make her at risk for more severe complications of COVID-19. Some people have been concerned about this risk of myocarditis. We see it in younger people, especially men. It is very mild and treatable, and we know that on multiple scales, the risks of getting COVID far outweigh the very small risks of the vaccine to your mom.
Thanks for that, Dr. Pierre. I'm going to go straight to another call, 800-423-8255. Amelia is on the line in Quincy. Amelia, go ahead.
Hi. My question is for the pediatrician. I am 6 months pregnant with my first child. I myself am vaccinated and boosted, but my parents are not. So I'm wondering to what extent I should be limiting or preventing my parents from seeing my son once he's born.
Dr. Landrigan.
Sure. Oh, great question. My wife's from Quincy, by the way. So I think the first thing is that if there's any way in the world you can persuade your parents to get vaccinated, do your best. I know it's not easy. People get fixed ideas. But if you can do it, it would be so good, not only for them, but also to protect you and your child. The problem is once you have your baby, and for a few months, the baby will have antibodies in her or his bloodstream that he will have acquired from you. But those will fade over time before the baby can get vaccinated. And during that, after the first month or two, you're going to have to be very, very careful about not putting your baby in proximity to your parents, because the infection can go either way, and it could end badly in either direction. So you really got to either keep distance or persuade them.
All right, let's stay with questions from the callers for a minute here. 800-423-8255. We have Heather on the line in Chelmsford. Heather, go ahead.
Yes, hi, doctors. Thank you. I have a 7-year-old daughter who is in the final stages of the maintenance phase of her treatment for leukemia. Thankfully, she is doing really, really well, and we're eager to have her vaccinated. Unfortunately, our understanding is that one of the components in the Pfizer and Moderna vaccine is a component, I believe, called PEG asparagine, and she had an allergic reaction to that during chemo. Any idea when the Pfizer pediatric vaccine will be available, and any other advice you could offer given our situation?
So I want to clarify, Heather, because I think you said that your daughter had an allergic reaction to a component of the Pfizer vaccine, but then you were asked when the Pfizer pediatric vaccine would be available. So just
excuse me, I meant Johnson & Johnson. I'm sorry.
Not at all. I just want to make sure we get the question you actually want answered. And so just because I tend to go back and forth, Dr. Pierre, do you have an answer to that, or shall I take that to Dr. Landrigan, who is the pediatrician?
I don't have a great answer for it. I would say that first of all, I'm glad to hear that your daughter is nearing the end of her treatment. There are people who have been concerned that they may have PEG allergies, and I think that warrants closer discussion and evaluation, if you haven't already, with an allergist, just to be sure that this is preventing her from getting the Pfizer and Moderna, just to be very sure. We have not heard about word, as far as my understanding, about when the vaccine ages will be lower or expanded for J&J.
And Dr. Landrigan, just giving you an opportunity to add anything there, if you have more or different thoughts from Dr. Pierre's.
Sure. No, what I would add is that the vaccine for young children are currently in clinical trials. And my understanding is that the results are expected early in the new year. If the results are as good as we all think they're going to be, then sometime, I would hope, in the first quarter, certainly the second quarter of 2022, there's going to be a recommendation for vaccination right down to the youngest ages, like down to age one.
And to follow up to the two of you, is there any, this is a genuine question from me, is there any reason that an mRNA vaccine would be different somehow in emergency use authorization or approval for young people under a certain age or kids under a certain age versus the J&J vaccine, which is developed differently, Dr. Pierre?
Right. So the one concern that we could potentially say is that we did see a very rare number, but cases nonetheless, of clotting with low platelet cases with individuals who had received the J&J vaccine. So that would be one potential concern that we would note, and the difference between mRNA vaccines and the J&J vaccines. I just want to note that those cases were very rare. So for children who have significant and severe reactions to components of the mRNA vaccines, I think that the J&J would remain a viable and important alternative for immunizing against COVID-19. But that is one potential thing that we would need to see, especially in the clinical trials.
And Dr. Landrigan, in general, how are our efforts now in the Commonwealth going in terms of getting children ages 5 to 11 vaccinated now that they are eligible for the Pfizer vaccine under emergency use authorization?
Everything is moving in the right direction. More and more 5 to 11s are getting vaccinated, and I encourage parents to keep it up. Keep doing it. You're protecting your children. You're protecting yourselves. You're protecting the seniors whom you might be dining with on Christmas or at New Year's.
And just to clarify, Dr. Landrigan, kids age 5 to 11 are now authorized for vaccination. That's relatively new. Kids 16 and 17 who were vaccinated more than 6 months ago are now authorized for boosters. But kids 12 to 15 are not in that booster mix yet, correct?
Yeah, it's confusing. I would think, you know, even if it's a bit off-label, if you have a chance to get a booster for a 12 to 15-year-old who had their shots more than, say, 4 months ago, if you could get it, I would take it. It can't harm, and it could increase the degree of protection.
Okay, let's go back to the phones. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. The calls keep coming in. Let's pick up Don in Arlington. Don, what's your question?
Hi, how are you? I'm a numbers person, and by all accounts, the vaccine is highly effective. Roughly 1,200 people under the age of 65 have died who have been vaccinated. It's a tiny number. Very few children end up dying. So if in the state of Massachusetts, we've got high vaccination rates, kids largely aren't affected. Again, roughly 1,200 kids dead of COVID under the age of 18 in the entire country. Why aren't we opening things up? What is the reason for continuing to do this another question that dovetails.
So I'm going to take it from you there, Don, and I do want to be clear. We're fact-checking Don's numbers. He put some data out. That is not our data, and I can't confirm the numbers that Don just gave us. The question, Dr. Pierre, and we hear this, I don't know if you heard our conversation before the break with Dr. Dan Baruch, but we talked about pandemic fatigue and people wanting the world to reopen. And one of the questions that I had made a note of today is with our numbers as high as they are in the Commonwealth, both in terms of people vaccinated, percentage of people vaccinated, but also case numbers. Are we expecting more people to say, well, either are the vaccines really working and or should we just be reopening and living through this? So your take as a professional, Dr. Pierre.
I think this is really, really hard. I think all of us, there would be no one, right, who doesn't want this to be over. When we look at where we are at this point, we are in a very different place than we are last year, and we should not miss that. Many of us have been vaccinated and have that protection, and many more of us are getting the booster. And so that puts us in a really good position to think about changing the way we celebrate holidays, thinking about travel. That being said, many of us remain vulnerable based on our health conditions, our age, or other factors that put us at risk. And our borders are porous. We know that there are other people who might be traveling, visiting, moving, who remain at risk as well. And so we have fluctuations in risk and protection. The issue that this causes is not just thinking about those numbers like severe disease or death that the vaccines have continued to protect us from, but other things that we really do need to prevent, like hospitalizations and severe illnesses that can keep us out of work and hamper our productivity. So those are the things that really we are worrying about and the reasons why we still need to use our layers of protection. I would say that things are a bit more open than they were last year. Thinking back to my last holidays, which were very dismal, they look a bit different this year. And I think the concern that we're having is the rate of recovery We think that we want to get back to where we were, and we do need to get back there. But opening up at one time could be disastrous. And so I strongly feel like we still need those layers of protection while thinking about what we can safely do that improves our quality of life.
So, Dr. Landrigan, I'll give a few numbers and give you a chance to respond to that as well. More than 11,000 new COVID cases in the state since the weekend. Number of patients with COVID in Massachusetts hospitals has increased to 1,355, the highest number since February 9th. And more than 80% of the population in the Commonwealth has received at least one dose of the vaccine. This kind of question is one I usually want to hear from both doctors on, because the more perspective we have from our local experts, the more it speaks to people. So your thoughts too.
Yeah. So let's pick up with Don's question where he noted that he's a numbers guy. So the population of Massachusetts is just a little below 7 million. The fact that 80% of the population has had at least one dose of the vaccine is very, very good. But do the math, the other 20% of 7 million is about 1.4 million people in Massachusetts still not vaccinated. That's more than enough unvaccinated people to completely overwhelm our healthcare system, overwhelm the hospitals if they were to get infected. And moreover, we're in a time of the year when three things are going on. We've got a new, very contagious variant circulating, the Omicron. Number two, it's cold weather, we're indoors. And number three, we're about to go into the holiday season. Some people are already in it. So all of those three factors are going to increase the potential for spread. So for all these reasons, the fact that we've got 1.4 million people in the state unvaccinated and a lot of mixing going on in the next 3 or 4 weeks, we have to be very careful, or we could have a huge surge. This is, unfortunately, I understand the fatigue. I understand what people like Don are saying. We all want to be past it, but we need to be wary. This is not the time to just relax. Throw away the mask and go out and party.
All right. Thanks to both of you for those answers. And the data that we have, according to the Boston Globe, 647 deaths among those fully vaccinated in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. We told you we would take a look at those numbers. Lots of calls still coming in. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to ask your questions. John, in Arlington, go ahead.
Hi, I've been hearing in the news, it appears that Omicron seems to be infecting mostly vaccinated people rather than unvaccinated people. One, is that true? And two, if so, why?
So thank you for that question, John. Dr. Pierre, as I understand it, that is not the case, but why don't I turn to you, see what you can do to answer John's two questions.
Absolutely. John, that is not the case. Omicron does not have a predilection to people who have been vaccinated. Unvaccinated and vaccinated people are being infected alike. What we do see is that, there is more transmissibility with this variant, and potentially the possibility of more escape or evasion of either infection-derived or vaccine-derived immunity. That being said, we have some more information showing that people who have been vaccinated and had received a booster have a reduction of risk for infection with Omicron, and that anecdotally, at the very least, we are seeing milder cases of disease. But as far as who is going to be infected, we are seeing in the unvaccinated as well as the vaccinated. And in terms of ratios there, we're still waiting for more info.
Great. Thank you, Dr. Pierre. We're going to stay with the phones here. 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've got Denise on the line in Warwick, Rhode Island. Denise, go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I had heard it from a reliable source on a PBS station that if you are somewhat immune suppressed, say not on cancer chemotherapy or something that bad, but still somewhat immune suppressed, you should have 3 shots of your mRNA vaccine and then 6 months later have a booster. I was wondering if, you know, what you folks may know about that. And for those of us who may have already, who have had our booster, just two shots of the mRNA and the booster, how long does that booster last? Because we saw waning effectiveness after 6 months of the two vaccines.
Thanks for that question, Denise. And Dr. Landrigan, we have had questions for clarification on this before, the difference between those who are immunocompromised and not considered fully vaccinated until they've had three shots, right? And then the booster would be something over initial full vaccination. So right. Maybe you can provide clarification for Denise here.
Yeah, well, I think, first of all, if a person is somewhat immunocompromised but still has a functioning immune system, it's very important to get the full suite of vaccinations, the two primary shots and the booster, and perhaps a fourth. Another question that's within your question is, how long are the antibodies going to hold up? We know that they wane over time. So if you've had three shots and four shots, how long are the antibodies going to hold up? I think the shorter answer is we don't know yet. Only time will tell, and people in infectious disease units, immunology units are tracking that. It's an important question, and I'm sure when we have more information, the word will go up. But in the meantime, be sure you get yourself fully covered.
So, Dr. Landrigan, I'm going to stick with you because we have a caller, Amanda in Sudbury, who specifically had a follow-up question to something she heard you say earlier in the segment. So, Amanda in Sudbury, you are up.
Okay. Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a 13-year-old son, and I'm very interested in what you briefly said about 12 to 15-year-olds getting an off-label booster. I don't know exactly what that means or where would I get such a booster.
And so, well, and this is just a moment where I'm just going to be super clear, one, that we're not asking our two doctors to provide personal direct medical advice based on somebody's particular case profile. Every once in a while, I think it's important for us to clarify that. And two, that we are talking about something that is outside the boundaries of what the FDA and the CDC are recommending formally at their level. Sorry, Dr. Landrigan. Now, please go ahead.
Yeah. Oh, this business about the absence of a booster recommendation for 12 to 15-year-olds is one of these little glitches that sometimes occurs in complex regulatory systems. Mm-hmm. I would say this is a situation where you want to consult with your pediatrician. If the pediatrician is willing to give a booster, I don't see any downside to it. But if the pediatrician feels that they shouldn't do it because of the FDA recommendations, I could not fault the pediatrician for doing that.
Thanks for that clarification, Dr. Landrigan. Let's go to Mitch in Jamaica Plain. And again, the number 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to ask your coronavirus questions of Drs. Cassandra, Pierre, and Phil Landrigan. Mitch, Jamaica Plain, go ahead.
Yes, my brother who is 70 got Pfizer all the way through his booster. 2 to 3 weeks later, he came down with PMR. Which I can pronounce if you're not familiar with it, but I expect you are. He found out that a nurse and her sister both got PMR after the same latency, the same severity. I just wonder if this has been recognized as some sort of a side effect.
Great. Thanks for the question. And Dr. Pierre, I do not know what PMR is. So maybe you can start by educating us all and then answering Mitch's question.
Yes, so I'm sorry to hear about this. PMR, or polymyalgia rheumatica, is a type of autoimmune condition. And it is not something that we have heard about, whether it be PMR or other types of autoimmune conditions that happen after receiving vaccines or booster doses. So what I urge people to do when they have experienced, you know, any kinds of complications within weeks or months after getting their vaccines is to go ahead and make sure that the physicians are aware of this and are reporting this to something that we call VAERS, or the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System, to be sure that the right people are getting this information and can track and evaluate it. That being said, we have no signal to date with the millions and millions of people that have been vaccinated to show that there is an association between Pfizer or other mRNA or other COVID vaccines with this condition. So I am really sorry to hear about this. Want to make sure that this information gets to the right people. But we don't have information about this on a very large population level to make us think that there is a link at this point.
And Dr. Pierre, I'm going to stay with you for a question from Lisa in Shrewsbury. Lisa, go ahead.
Hi, I have a husband who is 35 and for all purposes healthy. We have heard that these vaccine boosters are authorized but not necessarily recommended. At what point do we feel that they're going to be recommended for a healthy individual like my husband? I have been boosted and we live with my immunocompromised parents. So,
Dr. Pierre.
I think that's a great question, Lisa. So they actually have been recommended at this point. And I think the confusion here is that they've gone through multiple stages of perception. We have been saying for quite a while that our initial vaccine series are continuing to work for us against severe complications, hospitalization, and death, and that is still the case. But we have more information about the benefit of these boosters outside of people who are at higher risk for severe disease, outside of people who are more likely to be exposed to infection in the course of their work. There is a clear benefit to receiving these, and I think really the clincher has been the concerns regarding the Omicron variant, which, as we mentioned earlier, is highly transmissible, and it seems like in early lab-based studies, the booster dose does increase protection against that variant. So I would say because of all of those reasons, it is recommended. And I would also point out what Dr. Landrigan mentioned, we are moving into the holiday season and cooler weather, people are indoors, people are mixing more freely than they were last year. And in that situation, there's going to be a risk for more mixing, more exposure to COVID-19. In this scenario as well, the boosters are going to preserve our health and reduce our risk of infection.
So Dr. Landrigan, we're on limited time, so I'm going to ask you a question that Kimberly from Lawrence called in to ask, which is, Kimberly's worried about Omicron, worried about maybe reopening too quickly, kind of the opposite of Don's question. Are there restrictions that you would like to see happening in the Commonwealth with Omicron slowly on the rise?
Well, I think that people need to be situationally aware, and you have to look when you're going into a situation. You have to look around you and ask yourself, how many people are going to be in the room with me? If there's a lot of people, then the likelihood is high that some of them are unvaccinated, and that some of them are carrying and even shedding the virus. And so I think people, there's no one size fits all here, but I think people have to consider wearing masks in public circumstances. They have to, you may want to limit the size of your gatherings. If you have a gathering, you may want to ask that your guests do the home test the morning before they come over to your house, that kind of thing. It's basically a multi-layered protection that we need here. No single measure gives complete protection, but when you add two or three layers, you have pretty good protection.
All right. We have been doing Ask the Doctors since March of 2020, and we remain so grateful to all the physicians in our community who continue to help us do this week after week. If we were not able to get to your call today, I am sorry about that, but we will continue to do Ask the Doctors, so call in again next Tuesday. We will try to get to your question. Dr. Cassandra Pierre, infectious disease physician and assistant professor of medicine at the Boston University School of Medicine, thank you so much to you.
Thank you, Tiziana.
And Dr. Philip Landrigan, a pediatrician, public health physician, epidemiologist, and director of the Program for Global Public Health at Boston College. Thanks very much again to you today, too.
Thank you, Tiziana.
And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Chris Siderick, Walter Wuthman, Amanda Beland, and Cynthia Betubiza. Marquise Neal is our technical director. Karen Schiffman, our interim executive producer. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening and calling. Why don't you join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston?